Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments. Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, June 20th. I'm Ray Graff, reading the billboard for Alan Shartok. Underwriting support comes from Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center, offering an entirely online master's in nutrition and the RN to BS in nursing program. Open house July 7th in Poughkeepsie, adelphi.edu. Joining us today is Dr. John Mastrangelo. He is the chief of radiology at Nathan LaTower Hospital in Gloversville and is a board-certified radiologist practicing at Millennium Medical Imaging. He is here to answer your questions. Call 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Mastrangelo, Alan Shartok, your calls all coming up on Vox Pop Medical Monday right after the news.
Well, hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, and thanks to Ray Graff for doing the first introduction. WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us today is Dr. John Mastrangelo. He's chief of radiology at Nathan LaTower Hospital, practices at the hospital's Millennium Medical Imaging in Gloversville, where nobody goes barehanded. Dr. Mastrangelo earned his medical degree from Albany Medical College and completed his residency in radiology at Albany Medical Center. He's certified by the American Board of Radiology. Do you have a question for Dr. Mastrangelo? If you don't, I have plenty. Give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here again.
Well, it's great to have you, as always. So give us a little bit of a tour through what you, as my Aunt Ruth used to do, a tour through what you do over there. There's the various forms of CAT scans and other scans. What equipment do you have? Do you have it all?
Pretty much, yeah. We do a mix of different diagnostic studies, whether it be MRI or ultrasound, mm-hmm. or CT or X-rays, as well as using mammography and nuclear medicine in order to try to see inside the body and help the doctors make a diagnosis as to what's wrong with the patient.
Somebody.
Yeah, and we're getting in the near future tomography for breast imaging, which is a little bit more sophisticated way to look at the breast and can especially help with dense breasts.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. What does a CAT scan do for us? What does it take? Tissue? Does it take bones? What do we get?
Sure. So you get everything. You get a whole look at what's going on inside the body, and you can look at it in multiple different angles and planes. And you really get to see the heart, the lungs, the bone, the skin, the eyes, the brain, everything you want to see.
What does one of those machines cost?
The machine itself can vary depending on, if you want all the bells and whistles, latest and greatest, over $1 million.
Really? And keep on the tour. What's the next thing after CAT scans?
So sometimes after a CAT scan, you still don't know what's going on, and you have to get an MRI, which is a little bit more sophisticated. Doesn't use any radiation.
Right.
It takes a different approach to how it images, but still you see some similar things. You can still see inside the body, and you get some really exquisite images, a little bit better detail when it comes to contrast resolution. You can see, soft tissue structures, muscle versus fat versus fluid versus a mass. It really helps depict some of those things that the CT might not be as good at.
So when you are reading one of these things and seeing one of them doing it, and you see a mass, do you go to yourself, uh-oh?
Sometimes, yeah, depending on, when you know it's something bad. Certainly that's a thought that comes to mind. There are a lot of times, though, that you see it and you're like, oh, it's just lucky that it's this small and can probably be taken care of pretty easily. So.
Are you the reader as well as the overseer of the taking of these pictures?
So we do both. As part of our job as a radiologist is to not just interpret the images, but to constantly monitor the quality of the images, redesign the protocols to sort of maximize the equipment that we have to get the best quality pictures. And at times we're called upon to actually go in and biopsy a mass or take some fluid out of a collection in the body to help drain the collection and treat the patient or to...
So you have to do that.
We do that.
Not only a surgeon, huh?
That's correct.
Well, that's very interesting. I've now learned something for the day that I didn't know. When you do the... when you put the various dyes in, mm-hmm. I have heard over the years that maybe the dyes are not necessary all the time, are they?
Depends on what you're trying, the question that you're trying to answer.
Yeah.
The dyes, and there are different kinds of dyes depending
nuclear
on...
Nuclear dyes?
Or, sure. So nuclear medicine uses a different kind of a dye or injection mm-hmm. than a CT or an MRI. They're all different, and they're all used for certain purposes. So for a lot of things, you don't need contrast for. But for mm-hmm. certain things, you definitely need it, and it helps us to figure out what's going on.
So somebody will call up and say, do I need it? And you'll say, depends.
Right. Well, I'll ask them. And it's a fairly common incident that the doctor calls us and asks us, I'm looking for X. What kind of study do I need to order? And we tell them, you know, whether they need contrast, whether they need both without contrast and with contrast to help answer the question.
So let's say you're doing one of these studies and you see something that you don't like.
Yeah.
Do you just pick up the phone and call the provider?
If it's something that's bad and unexpected, yeah, we would. You typically do that.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Steve in Sullivan County. Okay, Steve, you're on. Steve.
All right.
Steve, you're busting up, Steve. What's the problem? Steve, I'm so sorry. We just can't hear you. If you can get to a landline, I think that would be much better. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right. Now we'll go to Ariel in Montague, Massachusetts. Okay, Ariel, you're on. Ariel? Hello, Ariel. I can see this is going to be one of those days. Should I try it again? Okay. Ariel, are you there?
Yes, Alan, I'm there. Are you there?
Yes, apparently we are. Okay, well, what do you got?
That's great. I have two questions for the doctor. The first one is, he just described an MRI as being somewhat more specific about a number of things than a CAT scan. So why would a physician ever have a CAT scan done? Why not just go straight to the MRI? And the second one is, it's based on a recent experience that I'm still in the middle of, and the question is, how would a CAT scan be useful in either confirming or ruling out someone having a kidney infection?
Sure. So those are both great questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The first one is a fairly common question. You know, you'd think that one study is definitely better than another for something. Why not only do an MRI for everything? And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that an MRI is not as good at seeing small things. So a spatial resolution, when you're looking for something very small, you're looking for a small fracture, you're looking for a small kidney stone that's only a millimeter in size, an MRI is not as good at seeing that. And there are a couple other things that, you know, a small fracture that MRI would not be as good as a CT scan, whereas a CT scan is very easily available. It is exquisite in its spatial resolution, whereas MRI is much better soft tissue contrast resolution. So they work together in many instances. Sometimes you need to get a CT first, and then you need to get an MRI still. And the doctors sort of know that going in, but you start off with the CT because oftentimes that's all that you need.
But isn't the CT more dangerous in that it's got radiation involved?
Well, I don't think that either one of them is dangerous, but there is a different way of doing it. So CT does have ionizing radiation, and an MRI does not. But the amount of radiation that you get from these studies is really quite low. And unless you're getting a lot of them and you're very young, I think that it's a fairly safe study to undergo.
Ariel, you any follow-up?
My other question had to do with how could a CT scan either confirm or rule out a kidney infection?
Right. So on a CT scan, you know, when you're looking for a kidney infection, oftentimes there's some sort of inflammatory change around the kidney that you can see. And in this case, as Alan talked about earlier, do you give contrast or not? When you're looking for an infection, contrast is very, very important in the kidney because something like pyelonephritis, you know, an infection of the kidney parenchyma, you'll see it as sometimes an area that's not enhancing like the rest of the kidney. And to put it simply, that's in part due to the edema and the infection and the inflammation that's going on in that segment of the kidney that's not allowing the contrast to go into the kidney and allows us to see it better. And you might even be able to see sometimes the infection can get so severe you'll get a renal abscess or something like that that might be extremely difficult to see without contrast. So CT is really, really good if the if your lab work is abnormal and they're really concerned that there might be an infection, to help them aid in determining how bad the infection is, what kidney it's coming from, and if anything interventionally needs to be done to help the healing begin faster.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Yeah.
Now it says here, okay, hang up. All right. Now, we got a new system here, Doc, so I have to be, like, when you get a new system, you got to be careful about the way you use it. Okay, we're going to take a very, very short break, and we'll be right back. And, Bonnie, you stay right there.
Support comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Protex Gloves, helping to provide relief from chronic skin and hand conditions, including peripheral neuropathy, scleroderma, Raynaud's, and eczema, UVA and UVB sun protection. ProtexGloves.com. Saratoga Hospital, committed to women's health with the Saratoga Midwifery and Women's Primary Care Practice. At exit 13 up the Northway, saratogahospital.org. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche, qfcc.com. And from Brattleboro Retreat, offering partial hospital and intensive outpatient care at the Birches Treatment Center. Full and half-day psychiatric and addiction treatment and on-campus housing available. BrattleboroRetreat.org/Birches.
And we are back with Dr. John Mastrangelo, Chief of Radiology at Nathan Litauer Hospital. Okay, so, John, if I may call you that, this is a very educational program, and I'm delighted to be having you here. We'll go to Bonnie in Connecticut. Okay, Bonnie in Connecticut, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling with regards to the capabilities of fMRI, and what I'm particularly intrigued by is fMRI capable at this time of detecting what could be determined as symptoms or indications of attention deficit disorder in terms of how the brain is firing away? And if it is not occurring at the moment, if they don't have that capability, is anyone in the field working on that idea?
It is an area that's being looked at. I don't know that there's any definitive data out there yet to show that functional MRI can do that, but it's certainly an area that's being studied. It's one of the up-and-coming sort of areas of neuroradiology using some,
you would think,
some more sophisticated.
How popular it is.
Absolutely, and it's not a lot of places do it, and it's certainly something that research is being done to see if it is valid and will be helpful in the future.
Could you distinguish for us, Doc, what fMRI is? Functional, what does that mean?
So functional MRI is not something that we do in Gloversville, and it's because it needs some special software. It's a more advanced MRI that really looks at how the brain works and actual individual neurons and how they work in conjunction with everything else. And and it's being looked at in terms of a lot of different neuropsychological issues and disorders like attention deficit disorder and different dementias to see. Multiple sclerosis to see how are things really working? What is the pathology involved to try to get a better assessment of disease and to hopefully guide treatment in the future?
So when we look at the plaque in an Alzheimer patient, who sees that?
So you don't see it necessarily on a routine MRI or MRA, but if you were to do a special kind of study and functional MRI could be one of those things that you could apply this to, that potentially you can see certain plaque burdens, or that's the hope, that's the goal of what they're researching. I don't know that things are there yet.
Bonnie, any more?
Nope, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. All right, let's go to Ed. And let me just say it's 1-800-348-2551. 348-2551. Go ahead, Ed.
Thank you. I have a similar question dementia-wise. PET scans.
Yeah.
If one has a PET scan that measures glucose metabolism and comes back negative, is there a good chance that if one had a PET scan that measures amyloid, that it would also come back negative? What are the chances? Is there a corollary?
So I'm not quite sure I understand. If you're are you talking about dementia and Alzheimer's, and you're doing a PET scan to look specifically for that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So PET is one of the standards that allows us to sort of see Alzheimer's. Unfortunately, sometimes you don't see it if it's very early and the amount of glucose metabolism in the brain and the areas that's affected by Alzheimer's. The idea is that you have dementia caused by Alzheimer's, and the disease process is causing a certain area, your temporal lobes and posterior frontal lobe, to use glucose less than it should be. And part of that is because of the atrophy, part of that is because of the disease. And so in order to see that on the PET CT, sometimes you don't see the very early stages of it. And so, as you're alluding to, sometimes maybe glucose metabolism might not be the best thing to look at for Alzheimer's, although it's pretty good, and that maybe there's other PET CT agents out there, a different kind of dye that you can inject, that will measure amyloid plaques. And then you'll look for just the opposite. You'll look for an area that has more amyloid plaques than not, to try to say, okay, this is beyond what should be expected for this patient, and this is probably early amyloid. So those two tests, are something that can be used to look at.
Do you do PET scans at your place?
We do PET scans. We don't do, amyloid tagging. We do the glucose tagging, as well as an agent to look at bone metastases.
So, Ed, you got anything else on that?
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Great question.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Bye-bye.
Yep. We'll go to, let's see here, Fred in Hurley. Fred in Hurley, you're on.
Hi, doctors. Good day.
Hello.
I have a friend. She's dealing with a condition where she has to have a paracentesis, extracting a fluid from her belly constantly. Her primary physician just retired. She's being bounced around. She doesn't have a whole lot of information. I'm wondering if there's an MRI or a CAT scan or any kind of procedural thing that would be able to help diagnose what's actually going on?
Sure. So it's something that we do fairly frequently, our paracenteses. And, for those that don't know, basically what that is putting a needle into somebody's abdomen because there's fluid there. And usually you do that with an ultrasound to guide you so that you know that the needle's only going into the fluid and it's not going to hit the bowel or an artery or something like that. And that allows you to be able to take out the fluid, which relieves a lot of the discomfort of having a fluid-filled belly, as well as allows you to analyze the fluid. So after you take out the fluid, oftentimes, based on what that fluid looks like under the microscope and the different laboratory tests that they run, you can get an idea of what's causing it. If that still is not helpful, then sometimes you have to get either a CT or an MRI to look to see what are the causes of ascites, and which is ascites is the name of the fluid in the abdomen. Do you need a liver biopsy? Do you need to look at, if it's a female, their ovaries? These are all causes, organs that sort of can cause the development and buildup of abdominal fluid. And so those tests, the imaging tests, as well as the laboratory analysis of the fluid itself, can often guide you into which way to go with that. And just so you know, something to think about, if this is something that's going to go on for quite a while, instead of having paracenteses week after week after week, there are other options that can be thought of, like a catheter that's placed underneath the skin, basically. And so
we know about that.
All right, and so that's.
But I just, it seems like they're dodging,
the underlying cause.
Yeah.
So that's always the issue, trying to make a diagnosis, and that's part of that is where, you know, radiology comes into play in terms of, in generally in medicine, you can't treat somebody if you don't know what's going on. So oftentimes the diagnosis of something is dependent on imaging. But in cases like this, there's lots of causes of ascites, and without seeing the images myself or knowing what's going on, sometimes it's tricky to determine what exactly is causing it. So I wish the best of luck to her, and hopefully they figure it out soon.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are 100%. 100%.
That's pretty good odds.
That's pretty good odds, right? 100%. All right. We'll go to Terry in Niskayuna. Okay, Terry, you're on.
Hi. In my mid-20s, I had gone for a CAT scan, and they found lung nodules. And they had me do a PET scan after that. And even though they weren't big, but they were in both, and the doctor was concerned, the PET scan came back negative. Then they had me follow up with CAT scans every 6 months to make sure the nodules weren't growing. And they had me do that for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. Then I was told to follow up every few years after that. I did not follow up every few years after that, and it's been 10 years now. I was concerned about the radiation, the amount of radiation I had in that short period of time. But I was wondering what your thought was and if it is something that I should now have followed up on.
Well, it sort of depends. When you see lung nodules in somebody in their 20s, they are overwhelmingly benign, greater than, mm-hmm. 99.5% of people with pulmonary
wow.
nodules less than 6 millimeters in size, if you're under 30 years old, are benign nodules. That's statistically proven. So, it sounds like they were big enough, though, that they wanted to be cautious and to have you follow up, occasionally. And so it's not unexpected that they didn't change in caliber or size, and that after their 2.5 year surveillance and saying that they're stable, I think it's safe to say that those are benign nodules. Now, you probably only had 5 or 6 CTs at the most, maybe, to look at those nodules. I'd say that's okay. I wouldn't be too concerned about the radiation dose from that, even though, you were fairly young. It's one of those things that, the cost of the radiation to your body versus determining that those nodules are benign, I think it was a good decision to do those CT scans. Just seeing a pulmonologist as a follow-up at some point, maybe if you could get a disc of those images just so that they can see what's going on, they might want to check a CT again just to say, hey, let's get another baseline and make sure that nothing's changed, and then put it to bed. But, it varies from patient to patient as to how aggressive you want to be and how much surveillance you want to do. But saying that it's been 10 years, you seem to be doing fine, and those nodules stayed the same for 2.5 years, it's extremely, extremely likely that they're going to be exactly the same as they were.
And if they looked at the nodules under a microscope, they would find?
So most nodules, especially in that patient, they're benign. So they're usually granulomatous disease. Like if we were in Arizona, for example, where that is endemic to the population there, everybody has pulmonary nodules there. It's not the case up here. So there's other causes of pulmonary nodules that are adenomatous or other sort of benign intraparenchymal lymph nodes that look like nodules, but they're little small lymph nodes. And you can't tell because you're really looking at things that are only 2 or 3 millimeters. But the worry is that you're seeing something when it's really small, and that 6 months later, that 3 millimeter nodule is going to turn into a 8 millimeter nodule. And then 3 months after that, that 8 millimeter nodule is going to turn into a 2 centimeter nodule. So you want to catch it early. And that's why you do the follow-up, to make sure that they're staying the same.
So I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
There are some people who want these full body scans.
Yeah.
Where they take a look at every single thing in your body. Now, I know that a lot of people worry about various sites in the body that are not detectable. What's the downside of getting a full body scan of everything in your body?
I don't know necessarily what the downside is. I think it's tough to do.
Too much radiation?
I think it's tough to do. Well, if you're going to do something, I'd say you do a whole body MRI.
Right.
So there's no radiation for that.
Right.
And there's something to be said for doing a surveillance study.
Well, what about pancreas, for example?
Yeah, so the pancreas, if there's something in your pancreas that is large enough to be seen on imaging, then typically it can be characterized fairly easily.
Right.
The danger is, and there have been some experiences that I've seen, that you do an ultrasound, and the ultrasound doesn't really get a good look at the pancreas ever because there's a lot of bowel
stuff
around the pancreas.
There's
stuff in the way that doesn't allow you to see it well. And then even on a CT scan that's done well, sometimes the pancreatic tissues, the pancreatic tumors, they're not able to be seen on CT scan because they're the same density as the adjacent pancreas or the surrounding bowel. And so you have to look for indirect signs. You have to look at the pancreatic duct to see if it's dilated. You have to look if there's a lymph node next to the pancreas that's too big. And so really MRI is very, very helpful in looking at the pancreas. So in that case, you know, a whole body MRI may show something there. But in general, you know, they have a very low yield to detecting pathology, really.
Okay, we'll now go to, thank you, Terry, and now we're going to go to Nancy in Poughkeepsie. Whoops, Nancy in Poughkeepsie, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a healthy 60-year-old woman. I get yearly mammograms. They always turn out great.
Great.
However, recently they've noticed some calcium deposits in one breast,
mm-hmm.
and it triggers multiple additional
Sure.
images to be taken at various angles. And I'm beginning to wonder over if I should be lucky enough to live to 80. You know, we're talking 20 years of many x-rays on one breast, which always turns out very happy in the end. The doctors are not worried. And yet, you know, due to caution, they do the same thing every year, that one breast. I'm wondering, am I tipping the scales? It is healthy now. Will it accumulate too much radiation, and could it tip it in an unhealthy situation? And my second question is, are any of my other organs nearby at risk with all this attention being paid to one breast that continues to come up healthy year after year?
Right. So I think it's a phenomenal question and something that, you know, something to be considered for sure. You know, when you take additional x-rays and their mammograms, the radiation dose that you're receiving, even if they take 3 or 4 extra diagnostic magnification views of those calcifications to try to further characterize them, that's okay. And down the road, maybe if you did that when you were 35 and you did that for 20 straight years, I might be a little concerned, but still, I think it's okay, and in many cases, it's necessary to try to figure out, okay, should these be biopsied or not? And that's the other thing. If it's an area that is constantly concerned and, you know, it bothers you, the other option is just to say, hey, just put a needle in, take a sample of the calcifications and put it to rest if we're going to keep doing this to get an answer and say, okay, these are benign calcifications or not. The problem is that as you age, and if new calcifications do come up, that's something that needs to be investigated every year. So if they notice that something is new or something is not like it was before, sometimes you still need those extra views to put to rest to make sure, okay, there's nothing concerning on those calcifications. They do look benign. You can come back in another year for your mammogram. And that's part of the job of that we do as radiologists in mammography, to survey for anything that is suspicious, and we can guide your breast care down the road for that. But I think you're certainly totally in the right track to question, you know, is this in my best interest or not to do it. And I think if there's something that is, you know, that they think needs extra views, it's probably a good idea to get those extra views just to make sure that you don't need to do anything further.
And the yearly instead of the every other year is still recommended?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of debate about that in the literature, and you know, there are different societies that come through with, oh, you can get it every 2 years or every year, and the American College of Radiology still says every year get your mammogram, and I'm fully supportive of that.
Thank you, Nancy.
And I've one last quick one.
Sure.
I've read where maybe a person should be asking for a shield for other organs if they're going in for these extra pictures year after year. Is there, and there aren't any nearby organs at risk?
You know, the dose, the radiation that you're getting for your mammogram doesn't travel very far in the body, but if you wanted to put a lead shield like over your abdomen, I don't think that's a bad idea either.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nancy. All right. Let's go to Steve, I believe, in Delmar. Steve, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I've got a question. Is there a machine that'll take both a CT scan and an MRI? And if not, why not?
I don't think that there is. And part of the reason for that probably is that the MRI machine uses very strong magnets to generate the images that you're seeing on a screen that look very similar in some ways to a CT scan. Whereas a CT, what goes around their tube is very different, and it shoots out, you know, radiation with detectors to capture that radiation on other sides of the machine. So the construction of the devices is very different technologies. So I think it would probably be difficult to combine the two, but maybe it's possible, just hasn't been done yet that I know of.
Great. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, great question.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a very short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, healthquest.org for locations. The Urological Institute of Community Care Physicians, a team of four uro-oncologists with 75 years of combined experience, providing advanced robotic surgery for kidney, bladder, and prostate cancer, urologyoncology.com. Curran Compliance Services, Greenwich, New York, and St. Paul, Minnesota. Compliance consultants to the life insurance industry, announcing a symposium in Albany starting this Wednesday through Friday. CurranCompliance.com. And from Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road, Colony, locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, RealSeafoodCO.com. And from New York Oncology Hematology, for over 30 years providing comprehensive treatment of cancer and blood disorders. World-class care close to home. NewYorkOncology.com.
And we are back, thanks to Zachary, who takes good care of us here from the engineering perspective. Let's go to Jim in Shutesbury. Okay, Jim, you're on.
Hi there. How you doing?
Hey, great. How you doing?
Good. I just had a question because I had, over the course of about 8 years, I had three or maybe four CAT scans of my belly.
Mm-hmm.
Had to do with diverticulitis.
Sure.
And at some point, my doctor got a note from the insurance company saying that my cumulative level of exposure was high, and that I should really, consider carefully, you know, having any tests like that again. And my doctor had never actually received a letter like that before, so he was kind of confused. And I was just curious if you, if this comes up in your practice at all, or is it something to really pay attention to?
I don't know that. I've never heard of the insurance company sending a note like that, and especially for four CTs in 8 years, that does not sound like it is over the threshold that I would even be concerned about it, especially if you're having an issue like diverticulitis, where oftentimes you do get a CT scan when you're having that similar pain to see, is this just our normal mild diverticulitis, or is this something more complicated? Has there been an abscess?
Right.
Has there been a perforation? Something that a surgeon needs to be made aware of to help fix it. So that doesn't seem like it would be too common from my perspective. But something that we do is we do track. In Nathan Tower, we definitely track people that get a certain number of CT scans, and when they are constantly getting a CT scan, whether it be because they're coming through the ER with similar complaints often, or they have a chronic problem that needs repeated imaging, it is something that we sort of track, and we do let the doctor know that's ordering it, hey, you know, this person has had X number of CTs over the past 3 years or 2 years or whatever. Next time when we're looking for this, if there's another imaging modality such as ultrasound, if you're looking for like a kidney stone, for example, let's start with an ultrasound to see if we can see if there's a stone there or not. Sometimes you can answer the question with that and save somebody that CT scan. But in your case, diverticulitis, CT is really the way to go. And I wouldn't have been too concerned about just getting, you know, three or four CTs over 8 years or so. That seems okay.
So could it also just be a greedy insurance company trying to tell people not to spend their money?
Well, that was certainly my take on it, was because my doctor had never received a letter like that before.
Right. Right. I mean, I would like to think that that's not the case, you know. Yeah.
Well, that's very, very well put. Thank you. All right. Okay. Thanks an awful lot. Appreciate you.
All right. Thanks, guys. Bye. Bye.
Okay. We'll go to Susan in Altamont. Okay, Susan.
Good afternoon, Alan and Doctor. I have a two-part question. My cardiologist wants to do a catheterization on me, but because I've gone into cardiac arrest twice with the IVP dye, I've been putting it off. When I talked to my breast surgeon the other day, she said she had to go through it too, and she's allergic to the dye, and that there's new protocol out there that can get you to have the catheterization done without dying on the table. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that. She said she wasn't even awake for it. She went through it. They filled her up with, I guess, antihistamines or something like that. And I was wondering what your take was on that.
It sounds like she did a pre-medication regimen, which is out there. There's a bunch of different ones where people take a combination of an antihistamine, such as Benadryl, in addition to a high-dose steroid, such as prednisone or something stronger, something hydrocortisone intravenously beforehand or orally, and then the thought is that is going to stop the allergic reaction that you get from the IV contrast. That being said, certain contrast reactions are not preventable, so you can still get a contrast reaction even if you have the pre-medication. There is that chance of happening. So you really have to weigh the risks and benefits of doing it. It sounds like your friend had the pre-medication regimen, and then she did okay once they gave her the IV dye during the catheterization.
I can't take prednisone. So right. Would I still be a candidate to be able to do this?
You know, it depends on if it's just prednisone or is it the entire, armament.
I know
of
I can't
steroids.
Take prednisone. I'm not sure about any cortisones, but I know I can't.
Right, so that's something to look into, and then make the decision from there in conjunction with your cardiologist.
Okay. And so the other question I had is, in 2014, I had 28 images, mammogram images. Then I had surgery because I had assertive breast cancer. And then 2015, they did a whole bunch more. Uh-huh. And now in 2016, coming in October, they want to do a whole bunch more. How much radiation is that to me? I was listening to your previous caller, but I didn't quite get the whole story on that. Is that way too much radiation
for
one breast?
Right. So they sort of do the concept of the radiation is ALARA. It's ALARA, as low as reasonably achievable is what it stands for. Mm-hmm. And that's set forth by our college, our breast imaging. And they detected a breast cancer on you. And you sound like you're doing well, which I'm glad for.
Yes,
but it seems like those images were necessary. And I think that's okay, and I think that hopefully when you get your mammogram this year, they only need to do the standard, two views of both breasts, or if they're doing tomography, then they do the one view with the tomogram images, and that's all you need. So each year it might be a little different, and certainly after you've had surgery, it changes how the breast looks, so that could be why they did a couple extra images on last year's exam. So
they're using a 3D imaging.
Correct, the tomography, it sounds like, is what it is. So. Good luck. Good luck going forward, for sure.
All right. Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome. Susan. Okay. We're going to go to Kate in Western Massachusetts. Okay, Kate, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about repeat CAT scans as well. I had a small grade 2 cancer kidney tumor removed last May. They wanted to follow me the original doctor wanted to follow me for 3 years. The doctor that I'm seeing now wants to follow me for 10 years. They're doing one CAT scan with and one without contrast. So I'm basically getting two CAT scans every time I go. There's some discussion about maybe doing an ultrasound on the odd years and skipping the CAT scan. But what does a CAT scan with as opposed to without contrast show, and why would they want me to do both?
So with renal masses, typically when we're looking at them, the standard protocol would be a without contrast study followed immediately by a with contrast imaging, and then another scan, a delayed phase, and that is to capture the contrast within the renal pelvis. And so you're looking to try to characterize the mass. So there are certain measurements that we take when we're looking at the image to say this mass is enhancing or it's not enhancing. If you can imagine something is dark on a non-contrast study, then after you give contrast, it lights up. That's a concerning feature of something that might be malignant. So we take those measurements.
Now they removed the tumor.
Correct.
They took a tenth of the kidney out with the tumor.
Okay.
So this is just follow-up to check if there's a recurrence?
Right, exactly. So they're doing a standard, sounds like a standard follow-up to say, is there anything enhancing in the surgical bed that we should be concerned about that looks like the original tumor that might signal a recurrence? That sounds like what's going on.
Okay. All right. So as far as the amount of radiation, should I go along with the, would it be better for me to have the ultrasounds every other year, or do you think it's safe to go ahead and still have the CAT scan?
You know, for me, if it was me, what I would personally do is I think I would have a CT done probably the first 2 years. And then if everything looks stable and things are going well, then you can consider alternating, you know, an ultrasound the following year and then a CT after that, just to save yourself a little bit.
I am 68, so yeah. It's not an issue because I'm young. So, but you would go ahead and do it?
I would.
Okay,
yeah,
Kate.
Okay.
Good luck to you, Kate.
Thank you.
Thank
absolutely.
You very much.
Great question.
Bye.
All right. And we'll go to Betsy in Woodstock. Okay, we're getting towards the end of the program, so let's all be brief. Go ahead, Doc. Betsy.
Hi, Doctor.
Hello.
I just had a double mastectomy in November. Last summer, I had a mammogram. It came back negative. And then for some reason, I decided to get my implants out. So I go to my plastic surgeon, and he said, let's do another mammogram before we start. And I said, okay. So I did, and that came back negative. And then like a week later, they said, there's a little something there, you know. So they said, go have a 3D ultrasound, and that's when they found the tumor, which, you know, makes me like really nervous about mammograms. Why don't women just get 3D ultrasounds instead of mammograms?
So it's sort of like the question about CT and MRI, in that mammograms are not perfect. It's not a perfect technology, but they're very good, and they have been shown to have a very good benefit as a screening test to try to capture breast cancer when it's early. That being said, it doesn't see everything. It doesn't make every cancer visible. And some cancers are better visible with ultrasound. So if you use the two of them together, you'll find more probably than either one individually. And then there's other technologies such as tomography or 3D mammography. That kind of technology is available. And that might capture a couple more cancers that are not as well seen on ultrasound or mammography. And then there's breast MRI. And not every cancer is going to be seen as well on ultrasound as it is on mammogram. So those tests all kind of work in conjunction with one another. In general, I still think this is proven in the literature, is that mammography is really the way to start out, whether you're doing the new 3D tomography or just regular 2D imaging as a good initial screening test. But there are certainly other technologies out there that might see something that mammography doesn't. And sometimes with the implants, that can obscure certain things on mammography, which is why every time somebody has implants, you get extra views automatically.
Mm-hmm.
You displace the implants and you get implant displaced views, and then you get your routine views to try to get some of that tissue out of the way so that you can see something that might be small that the implant might be hiding too. So
yeah,
and
they hurt like hell.
I'm so sorry to hear that. You had to go through that.
Okay.
But I'm glad they found it.
I think I'm so lucky to think of having my implants out, or I would have never found it.
Right, exactly. You know, it's just a.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of this stuff gets caught
incidentally
by accident.
Yeah. Yeah, we call it an incidental finding. Somebody's coming in for a acute appendicitis, and you see, there's a 1.5 centimeter lung mass.
Yeah,
you know, and that's one of the dangers of coming in for imaging. You know,
and I'm thinking about full body where they get all these false positives. Also.
It's true. Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Hey, thank you so much, Betsy. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck
doctor.
With everything.
Bye.
Good luck.
Okay, and we'll go to Susan in Chatham. Okay, Susan, you're on.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question, and some of which you just answered in the previous caller's answer. I had a lumpectomy last year for a 0.7 millimeter grade 1 tumor, and that was detected by my annual mammogram. And now I'm scheduled for another mammogram in a year later, but I'm just wondering about the my surgeon is saying, why don't you have the 3D done? But my oncologist is saying it's fine, just to have the regular mammogram. And I'm just wondering if you have an opinion one way or the other. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think that in general, if I had to choose between a two-dimensional mammogram and a three-dimensional tomography, I would go with the three-dimensional tomography. That does, I think, allow us to see certain things that might be masked by a two-dimensional image. That being said, there are certain things like calcifications that sometimes are better seen with the regular two-dimensional image. So the fact that you've already had a mammogram and they detected the abnormality on that kind of study, I think both the regular three-dimensional and the two-dimensional mammograms are very similar enough that I think you can't go wrong either way. If it was me, I'd probably go to the three-dimensional.
Okay, that's what I was kind of thinking, and then I thought, well, maybe I'll alternate one year.
I don't think there's any. I don't think there's any wrong answer.
Okay, thank you so much, Susan.
All right.
Okay, we'll go to Lisa in Glens Falls. Okay, Lisa, you're on.
Thanks so much for taking my call, Doctor. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about video capsule endoscopy and whether it can be used to differentiate between colitis or Crohn's. I have a nephew who suffered from this for 10 years, and they still aren't really able to tell the difference. And he's at a point where he might need to consider surgery.
Sure. So that's not something that is done by radiology. That's something that that's okay. It's something that the GI doctors typically will give you a capsule, and there's a camera on it, and it'll go through you swallow it, and it'll go through your whole digestive tract, and they'll take pictures as it goes through to see where the inflammation is. And so the thought is that you would be able to tell, if there's something that's involving the small bowel, if there's inflammation in your terminal ileum, which is where Crohn's disease really affects, that would make you think, oh, this person might have Crohn's disease, versus if there's inflammation in your rectosigmoid colon or your transverse colon, which is more of a colitis picture. The other thing that could be done that we do is a MRI enterography, which is something similar to other MRIs, but they take a different sort of contrast, which slows down the bowel and allows us to see enhancement to look for some of the typical findings of Crohn's disease. So that's another option, but they work in conjunction with one another. Unfortunately, we're not the ones who do the capsule endoscopies like you're talking about.
Is there a lot of prep for the MRI enterography for someone who's like in active disease? Would that be difficult?
Yeah, we do a lot We do it a lot oftentimes in people with active disease. The thing that sometimes is problematic is the oral contrast. You just have to drink a lot of it to sort of distend your bowel. And sometimes people will have some vomiting issues with that. But some people handle it without a problem. It's really hit or miss. But oftentimes you get a good study either way.
Okay, we're running out of time. Thank you for your call. Appreciate it very much, Cynthia. Wish we could give you a little bit more, but Lisa. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's terrific. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And very, very quickly, Cynthia, you got about a minute. Go ahead. What do you got?
Okay, just a question about dense breasts. And I've had mammograms for all my life. I'm almost 70. And just wondering about the ultrasound and whether that would be advisable, and 3D or regular ultrasound as opposed to a mammogram.
Yeah, so I think that the two studies, I think, working together would be best. I think a mammogram in addition to an ultrasound, and whether you do a mammogram in 2D or 3D or an ultrasound, either way, I think the two studies together is beneficial for somebody with dense breasts.
So, Doc, are they making mammograms any easier? I know when my wife goes, there's a certain pain factor that comes with them.
Unfortunately, no, and part of that is because you want to compress that tissue out there, because if you were just to image somebody's breast without making it flatter to get some of the tissue out of the way, it would look like a white blob, and you would miss, you know, you wouldn't be able to see some of the things that you can see when you actually compress it out, and unfortunately that is not comfortable.
Okay, so I don't want to ask an ignorant question. I only got a second or two. Does breast size matter in terms of pain?
I don't know that it does. I don't think that just because you have larger breasts, I don't think necessarily think that means that they're more painful during the compression portion of it.
Well, thank you all very much for your great calls. Appreciate it very much. Doctor, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
So anyway, we're out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. Apologize to no one because no one was left on the line. I'd also like to thank our wonderful guest, Dr. John Mastrangelo, for joining us today. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York, proudly introducing the gastroenterologist specialist of Litauer, working to provide patients with comfort during colonoscopy procedures, NLH.org. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz, always in charge. Our producer's Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.